The Words We Live By. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today, we present Wisdom Books of the Bible, the second in this series of 15 outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel, two of America's foremost men of letters. Mr. Samuel.
Mark, I think we are ready in our talk today to examine in a little more detail the text of Proverbs in the light of the definitions that we agreed on or half agreed on in our last talk. I want to begin, however, with this suggestion. I'd like to know what you feel about it, that the wisdom books represent one of the three modes of human motivation. In one, we've got the prophetic guide to human behavior. In one, we have the priestly guide. In one, we have the wisdom guide. Each of these approaches has its advantages and its difficulties. In the prophetic, we are bidden to consider what God wants us to do in general terms, and we are thrown upon the intuitive. The danger is there that we fall into a sort of antinomianism. We've got no regulations. We are dependent always upon inspiration. In the priestly code, we are given very specific guidance. We are told of penalties and expiations, and the danger there is that we fall into a rigid formalism. In the wisdom literature, we are given the wise man's, the worldly man's outlook on human behavior, and the danger there is that we fall into shrewdness or cunning.
Or prudence.
Or prudence. And in fact, the word prudence occurs also side by side with those three attributes of wisdom that I spoke of last week, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. There is also the word orma, which is prudence and might even be shrewdness. So this is the third coordinate. If you want to speak of behavior as being three-dimensional and solid, this is the third coordinate. The wisdom books say next to nothing about the prophets, next to nothing about the priestly code. They do mention, you may find mention in Proverbs, pay your first fruits and give your tribute to the Lord and he will bless you. But that's almost a formal, offhanded recognition. We are thrown back upon the worldly wise, the intelligently decent estimate of life. Now, we've got to look at that in the text in the light of what you said last week about the Jewish and the Greek attitudes toward life, and see if we can get some system out of the book of Proverbs and the other books that we're going to examine.
First of all, however, Maurice, let me remind you of something that I believe is true, namely that during a certain period of the ancient Hebrew experience, men of wisdom, wise men, men who said things such as we're reading here, were almost a profession or caste in themselves. Isn't that true?
Yes.
There was a time they were not priests, but they somehow were a body of men who nursed in their minds and in their memories a series of sayings which had great antiquity, we can be sure, which were supposed to have come down from the fathers, things that had always been understood. These men were, in a sense, the guardians of these sayings. They were the men who knew how to say them. They were men who knew how to put them into words, and they had been put very brilliantly into words at some time way in the past, oftentimes into words that were now difficult to understand. The ethics of the fathers says to us once that we should never try to say anything that is difficult to understand in the hope that it will be ultimately understood. We better make it clear right now. On the other hand, the wisdom writers have great respect, apparently, for what they call dark sayings, for riddles or puzzles, things that at first blush don't seem to mean very much, but which upon examination yield very rich meaning. That's only a footnote to what you were saying. The wisdom writers, the wisdom, the priests, they were almost priests of wisdom.
I think that's correct. It goes back almost to the tribal concept of the wise old man, the repository of experience and records. And I wonder if we can make a little digression here. Have we got anything like it in our modern concept of human relations? The wise old men, those that you go to listen to and whom you trust as having accumulated, sifted, and classified the results of a lifetime of experience. We haven't got that attitude toward old people now, have we?
I'm afraid we haven't. We can both say we are afraid we haven't in view of our own greatly advanced age. Of course, I'm older than you.
Oh, several weeks, I believe. Yes.
No, I'm afraid we haven't. We no longer assume that there's such a thing as the old man of the tribe who knows things merely because he's lived a long time.
It's rather a pity, at least for a negative reason, there is an attitude now toward the older man that he's got to be very chipper and very young. There must be no evidence of any decline. Also, since it might reflect upon his condition, no evidence of having lived long in any sense at all.
Yes,
but to go back to what you raised before, these men, as the carriers of the civilization, one might call them, they were, as you suggest, almost a class apart. They were honored. Very possibly it led to abuse of their position. But it was a distinctive feature of that time, and I think this was true among the Greeks as well as among the Hebrews, the old man as the person to listen to.
And by the way, I think we must face the fact that probably some of them were boors.
Oh, there's no question about it.
They were Poloniuses. After all, there's yes. A famous case, isn't there, in the play Hamlet. Here's this old man who knows all the old saws, and he insists on giving them to his son.
Yes, he never says anything foolish and never says anything interesting.
That's right, never very interesting. Yes, it's good enough, but usually when that scene is performed on the stage, his son Laertes is yawning and looking over his father's white head at his friends and smiling and saying, well, I've got to take this, but it doesn't mean much to me. I'll take it to Paris, where he's going. I'll take it in my luggage, and I'll leave it in my suitcase. I won't take it out.
Here's something else, Mark, that I want to hear you talk about. The question of the fool in wisdom literature. You've noticed, of course, that there is a tremendous emphasis on the fool, as though it isn't merely a person who lacks understanding. It isn't merely a person of whom we say negatively that he has not acquired information. He's a sort of a sinister buffoon. He is a figure dedicated to the suppression of knowledge, to the derision of knowledge, a sort of a huge tidal resistance to man's intellectual refinement and to the research into the mysteries of life. Over and over again, the fool does this. Fools die for want of wisdom is one verse. A fool's lips enter into contentions. And then one passage, though you bray a fool in a mortar and pestle, he'll remain a fool. As a dog returns to its vomit, so a fool returns to his folly, and so on and so on.
Well, I think we have the same idea. We all recognize fools today, and we're very likely to say of them, they remain fools. Nothing can ever make them wise. If they are corrected on one point, they are erroneous on the next point. They never seem to learn anything. I would say, Maurice, that the concept of the fool here is mainly the concept of a man who cannot learn. And not only cannot learn, but doesn't want to learn. He's the sort of man who doesn't listen. He's the sort of man who doesn't consider. He's the sort of man who thinks no one else could ever correct him.
Is there something about him of a primal malevolence?
Well, it seems to take that form sometimes. I mean, it looks as if it meant that. The word that we have, docility, which often has an unpleasant connotation, but at its best has a great connotation, that word docility applies, as I understand it, to a person who is continually learning.
Teachability.
Teachability. He likes to be a student all of his life and doesn't assume that there isn't some man somewhere who couldn't tell him something, who couldn't teach him something. That's why he reads books. That's why he listens in conversations. And we often call him a good listener. But the fool here, and I think the fool with us too is a man who never listens. He knows. Those are just words that you're speaking. I know myself. I'm a knowing fellow.
It's an active, destructive principle.
It seems to me finely malevolent and finally very terrible. I don't know anybody in my own experience more somehow odious than the person who gives me the sense that he never wants to hear me tell him anything. Or never wants to hear anyone tell him anything. He dismisses all things as specious. All things are probably attempts to fool him.
Now here you see is part of the...
He thinks he knows everything already.
Part of the difficulty with the text. At the very beginning, wisdom crying in the streets. She says, "How long, ye thoughtless, will ye love thoughtlessness? And turn you at my reproof," she says to the fool. "Behold, I will pour out my spirit unto you. I will make known my words unto you. Because I have called and ye refused, I have stretched out my hand and no man attended." Apparently, in this particular passage, that hopelessness, which does appear elsewhere, is dropped. That they are teachable. Do you remember that essay by Hazlitt? Of course you do. Where he tells us that a nasty person just can't help being nasty.
Yeah.
And that it's no use for him trying to be nice. The harder he tries, the more his nastiness creeps out. It's something that's indestructible and unchangeable. If that is true of the fool, you might say, here's a person who has been damned from birth. There's no hope for him.
Yes.
Is that what they mean predominantly?
I'm afraid they do. I'm afraid they were thinking about something and I'm looking at right now in the book of Proverbs in the fourth chapter, the seventh verse. The beginning of wisdom is, get wisdom. That's a curious sentence when you think of it.
Yes.
The beginning of wisdom is, get wisdom. In other words, the wise man is the man who wants to be wise, and incidentally, by the way, will continue all of his life.
Yes, that's a very good quotation of yours. I'll tell you a story that occurs to me now. Once at a lecture on Jewish culture, I was confronted with a question from the audience. A woman got up and said, very simply, "Mr. Samuel, how can I get cultured?" And some foolish people tried to shoo her down. They thought she was simple, but it was a very subtle question. And I said to her, to the extent that you want to be cultured, the extent that you come and listen and learn, you are cultured. The question about becoming wiser and learning more is something else. So merely to want wisdom is to be wise. You're perfectly right. This is the subtlest point in the book, perhaps.
Oh, yes. And incidentally, it's a moral virtue. Now, the old phrase intellectual virtue might refer to the capacity that we have to learn. But the desire to learn is somehow a moral desire, isn't it? It's a willingness to be taught.
Yes.
A humility. A belief that maybe one is not wise enough already, but could always be wiser. There is a moral dimension there that we do not find in the strictly intellectual virtues.
Now, to come back to what we discussed last week, you say a moral dimension. Was that present among the Greeks, do you think?
No, I think not. Not in nearly the same sense.
Well, if a man like Newton could end his life saying that he knew practically nothing, and if an Einstein could say it, then certainly it means that the degree of knowledge doesn't determine a man's wisdom. It's the attitude toward knowledge and what you've called the docility of the man, the teachability of the man. But let's get back to this dreadful problem of the fool. And, of course, I have no guarantee that somebody listening in just now isn't saying, what's that fool talking about? Or people...
Oh, I'm sure
I have no guarantee either that he mightn't be correct. I smile at the notion in my superior way, of course.
Let me tell you.
But the fact is that there is no test, and no man is ever beyond the possibility of this reproach and of this condition.
Well, let us make perfectly plain to each other, if not to any third person, that that each one of us thinks he might be very foolish, and that is the beginning of wisdom, I dare say. But there are certain things that the Book of Proverbs, in particular, says with great wisdom, it seems to me, on this whole subject. It describes the wise man in certain extensions of his character. For one thing, he is serene and merry of heart. Remember, they talk a good deal about that. A merry heart maketh a cheerful countenance, but by sorrow of heart the spirit is broken.
Yes,
he that is of a merry heart hath a continual feast. In other words, they like to think that wisdom could make a man happy. Not slap-happy, he wouldn't be a cheerful idiot. He would be very well aware of the difficulties and dangers of the world, but he wouldn't be, as the fool is, ever in a state of perpetual panic, just as he would be slow to anger. See, the fool is quick to anger. Isn't that always what they're saying?
I want to go to something that you mentioned before about the cheerful man. You're perfectly right. A man has to... the wise man is a cheerful person, and then you very aptly made the distinction between the cheerful person and the slap-happy idiot. Because, again, there is the warning in the book of Proverbs, as vinegar on the teeth, he says,
yes,
is a man that sings to somebody who is in misery. There is a tendency nowadays to look at the grinning person as the right person. And it's a particularly... frequent among persons in public relations. The slapping on the back, the perpetual grin, the perpetual showing of the teeth in the gesture or the grimace of an empty and vapid, almost imbecilic cheerfulness.
That's right. One gets terribly tired of the smiles, the artificial smiles in advertisements and commercials and whatnot. Everyone is supposed to be just... obviously happy all the time. A happy man, of course, could have a very straight countenance.
Actually, if one were continuously cheerful, one couldn't say things as bitter, as pointed, and as piercing as we find throughout the Proverbs. My mind reverts just now. As a ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a fair woman that turneth aside from discretion. Can't say that with a smile, can you?
No.
Especially if there are women present.
Or this, wrath is cruel and anger is overwhelming, but who is able to stand before jealousy?
Well, these are very serious, grim sayings, aren't they?
Of course they are. Well, life is grim enough. Whoso diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it shall return upon him. Oh, yes.
As to what the fool can do with wisdom itself, there is that saying you remember in the Ethics of the Fathers that a man must not separate himself from the community. And in Proverbs, we've just alluded to those sayings, to those adages or aphorisms or guides, that a man must be cheerful on the one hand, but he mustn't carry it to extremes. When people are in bad mood, he mustn't intrude with his cheerfulness. I'm reminded, Mark, of a story that Sholem Aleichem, the great humorist, used to tell about himself, of course, tongue-in-cheek, as to the way in which he carried out the instructions of the wise men of old. He said, I never separate myself from the community. When the community is sad, I am sad with it. When it's cheerful, I am cheerful with it. When I used to go to market with my father as a boy, and we used to come back from the market, we always used to say the opposite of what had happened. If we'd sold everything and made a lot of money, we used to say, we hadn't sold a thing and we'd lost all our money. And if we had actually lost everything, we'd say we made a lot of money. The reason was, he said, that if we made a lot of money, we came back and told them we lost everything, we were cheerful and they were cheerful. Mm-hmm. If we had lost everything and we came back and told them that we made a lot, then we were cheerful and they were cheerful. Mm-hmm. This was his illustration of what the fool does with these wise sayings of the fathers.
Very nice. Of course, I like to say, in my own experience, as a result of my own experience, that those persons who have been, as we say, educated and who seem to be unhappy, in my opinion, could not have been well educated. Education should make us happy. Education should make us somehow not content with the world in any complacent fashion, but somehow able to accept it. Because the power to accept the world, after all, is a very great power, to accept it as it is. It's a grim place, to be sure, and it's grimness we accept along with other things. You spoke of the Ethics of the Fathers a minute ago. I find one terribly interesting statement about scholars there, or wisdom writers, and the fool would probably take this much too literally. I read here, warm yourself by the fire of the scholars, but beware of their glowing coals, lest you burn yourself. For the bite of scholars is as hurtful as that of a fox. Their sting is as deadly as that of a scorpion. Their hiss is like that of a serpent. And all their words are like coals of fire. Well, that would be most true for a fool.
Well, I think there's some reference there to the quarrels that there are among scholars. You know, when scholars get into a quarrel, they can be as rancorous, I'm afraid to say, as fishwives. there have been some famous quarrels in the scientific world. You remember the quarrel there was between the followers of Adams, the English astronomer, and Leverrier, the French astronomer, as to who had calculated the position of the planet Neptune. They went into it with a fury which was most unedifying. And similar quarrels as to who discovered the differential calculus first, whether it was Newton or Leibniz.
Leibniz.
Yes. Now, there's a reference to it there. There's also a reference to the fact that a learned man can be extremely bitter in his language and has a way of getting under your skin that the ignorant man doesn't possess.
Yes, but I like to think also that the truth can be bitter. The truth can seem to sting and hiss, because the truth is not always simply, in the most obvious way, agreeable.
That's right.
Now, but the wise man will nevertheless state it. And it will apply to him or apply to anyone else. He doesn't care. He will state it.
You were talking last week of the... and it has reference to part of this. You said that there was an apparent contradiction, at any rate, between the injunction and the ethics of the fathers not to say something which will be understood later, and...
Only later.
And at the same time, they speak of dark sayings, chidot in Hebrew, the riddles. Yet... there's no help for it sometimes. When they say in Proverbs, the sluggard, the lazy man says, there is a lion in the streets.
Oh, yes.
Now, what does he mean by that?
Well, I take it that he means, I don't have to go out to work because there's a lion. I can just stay here and lie on my bed and spend the day.
But you see, the simple man would say,
it's an
I know what he's talking about. This is a dark saying, isn't it?
Oh, that's
this is
true.
A riddle.
Yes, that's true, just as this.
But could it be put any better, really?
Oh, I think not. As a matter of fact, in one sense, all the proverbs, all the sayings are metaphors. They are figures of the truth. Now, the truth itself is probably unstatable. If it could be stated, it might be stated in just one word. Maybe it's something to be seen in silence rather than to be expressed. But men are talking creatures, and they have to keep on talking. When they say the things that are said here, they probably have to reach for figures, for similitudes. I understand it that the word we translate as proverb, the Hebrew word we translate as proper, suggests likeness or similitude.
That's right, yes. It's a parable.
A parable.
Yes.
It is something like this. In other words, you ought to know what the wisdom is. You ought to know what the truth is, my good friend. But if you don't quite know, I'll give you this saying, which you can chew upon and which
yes.
you can take away and reflect upon, and maybe that will...
Maybe it'll steal in on you after a time.
Was there ever any difficulty, I wonder, with the beautiful proverb, better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a stalled ox and hatred therewith? I suppose that's not really difficult, is it?
No. The stalled ox means the eating of an ox which has been well fed.
Yes.
But now you're talking...
In other words, better live simply with love than
yes.
richly...
Well, that's a very deep saying.
And elaborately without it.
And it also may imply that one of the prices of living elaborately is that there's going to be a lot of quarreling, a lot of emulation and rivalry. But now that you mentioned the question of the ox, here's a very neat phrase. Where no oxen are, the crib is clean.
Oh, yes.
Now, a man may be boasting, my crib is clean, or my stable is clean, because actually he hasn't got oxen, he's not looking after them, and very possibly, if you're going to lead a busy life and a productive life, you can't have the neatness that some pedants might demand. But it's quite possible that we've lost some of these sayings that in time... The phrasing and the allusion has evaporated out. We can't recapture it. I was thinking of a phrase I heard once at a meeting where money was being raised. A man said very simply, you can't take it with you, but you can send it ahead.
Oh.
Now, if one didn't know that particular phrase, you can't take it with you, which has passed into the language,
yes.
one wouldn't know what he's talking about, would one?
That's right.
Now, that may be true with some of the proverbs.
I mean, someone might say, a fool might say, what is it?
Yes,
is that what you mean?
That's right, yes. No, it needn't be a fool either.
No.
Supposing we'd forgotten.
All right.
It had passed out of the language, a man would say, what does he mean? You can't take it with you. It depends. It's a proverb is, after all, the distillation of a civilization as well as the wisdom of a person.
Well, proverbs once were defined, I don't know how long ago, as a proverb was defined as the wisdom of many and the wit of one.
Excellent.
I think it's a very fine statement.
Yes.
Very fine definition. In other words, these are things that all men know, who know anything. But it took one man to put it this brilliantly.
And that man has been forgotten as a rule, hasn't he?
Yes. Of course, we don't know who he is.
It seems to be almost an essential for a thing to be perfect that its author shall be forgotten.
Maurice, wouldn't you think this might be an example of that? There are many proverbs in the Book of Proverbs itself that have to do with the man who refuses to be told anything, the man who refuses to be corrected, the man who refuses to admit that he could be wrong. And that's simple enough. But in one proverb, in the 15th chapter, 32nd verse, I find this: he that refuseth correction despiseth his own soul. That's a very interesting twist or turn given to it.
He that refuseth correction despiseth his own soul. Okay. Yes.
It's not too easy.
It is self-destructive. Mm-hmm. You bristle when you're corrected, and any benefit that you might have derived from it not only slips past you, but it becomes the occasion for the perpetuation of your stupidity.
Yes, you have a kind of contempt for your own soul, which you think could never become any larger.
And you
protect it from, yes, from enlargement.
Yes. Very close after that, in the following chapter, or a couple of chapters later, there's a verse which reads, "Let a bear robbed of her whelps meet a man, rather than a fool in his folly," which means it's less horrible to see a mother bear deprived of her whelps encountering a man than to see a fool in his folly encountering a man. There's a curse in Yiddish which says, "May God send a fool upon him," which is one of the most horrible experiences to use.
Yes, what could be worse?
Yes. Just imagine then, you're trying to correct a man, and the man despises his own soul. He has no use for what you want to tell him.
You know, these men, of course, were marvelous psychologists, too. There's one thing I love. The words of a whisperer are as dainty morsels, and they go down into the innermost parts of the belly.
Yes, yes.
These things that you love to hear, these flatteries, or these rumors, or these bits of gossip, that you shouldn't be taking into yourself, you drink them in deep and deep, because they taste so good.
In particular, he is aiming there at the whisperer, which means the slanderer, the backbiter.
Yes.
And telling us how we all love to listen to it. They go down, we digest them, and we forget that in slander there are two sinners. There is the talker and there is the listener. Yes. And the evil of it is the enjoyment with which you receive it, in the absence of which the other man wouldn't be talking of these things. Right. But there'll be a lot of these proverbs for us to discuss, and I'm afraid we shan't have time for more than a small fraction of them.
Well, let's do some more, however, next week.
Yes.
You have just heard The Words We Live By, the second in the 15-week Eternal Light Summer Series. We invite you to join us again next week for another in this series of outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel. Our program will be the third of five, entitled Wisdom Books of the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
I invite you to hear Toscanini, the man behind the legend, a regular weekly feature on NBC Radio.